We've got a few minutes for questions, if anybody has any Dhamma questions.
And I'm sure how to articulate this, but I kind of feel like I'm in this place where I listen to the talks and I read the book, and everything is so logical and rational, and it makes a lot of sense. But then somehow still, it's like really hard to elevate the practice to where it needs to be, because it's like stuck in these habits, you know, it's like the habitual patterns of living as a lay person. So, I don't know, it seems so strange to me how you can recognize something as rational, logical, good for you, but you're still just getting the same old problem. So I don't know if that speaks to you, or if you could speak to that in any way.
I think one of the things is to recognize that that's really common. that's kind of baseline where you know we actually can we know or have an intuitive sense of what's right, what we should be doing. But yeah, it's difficult to actually do it, and that's an age-old problem. And I think that's one of the things why the Buddha put tremendous emphasis on drawing close to the teachings, drawing close to the teachers, and then drawing close to the community, so that there's one has a network of support that isn't just our own good intentions, because the good intentions arise and pass away, but finding trying to find something that gives a continuity, and that's where having a community, and whether it's an actual physical community, like coming up to the monastery, plugging into the routine of the monastery, like Saturday night talks, lunar observance talks, or online, which is, because of the pandemic, there's an increased access, I think, to Dhamma resources, because so many places and teachers are making the teachings available and making their, like here, the evening pujas. We just turn the camera on and the mics and do the chanting, sitting, and nothing special, but every day all sorts of people plug in for the pujas, chanting and meditation, and then of course on when it comes to Saturday or the lunar observance talks, and those happen, but having that continuity of support, and that's why the Buddha placed tremendous emphasis on that sense of good spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, because it's hard to do it. It's hard to maintain it for ourselves, and in our own minds are so fundamentally unreliable. Oftentimes people will ask, what's the benefit of being a monk? What's the benefit of living in a monastery? And I think, it's kind of, I say it jokingly, but it's quite true that one of the benefits is that when you're living with a group of people, not everybody is depressed and lazy and fed up at the same time. And there's, it's just very fundamental. It's just, there's like a momentum going that helps to carry, and then that's something one can give to as well. So it's like trying to find those support groups, and that's what say within a lay life, I think it's quite important to look for places and ways where one can draw close to others who are practicing. Again, it's the pandemic's sort of thrown a monkey wrench into many of the actual physical groups of people actually gathering, but there's still I think there's increased opportunity through online resources, and then certainly you live in the Bay Area, don't you?
Not anymore.
Oh.
In the Lake Tahoe area.
Yeah, Lake Tahoe area. Oh, okay, so that's further away. But still, it's sort of even there. I'm sure there's got to be these days in America. There's just sitting groups everywhere, and it's just I think it's important to try to reach out and look for those resources, but it is that external support. I mean, there's an internal support of our own reflection, investigation, our own discipline, and but I think it can't be underestimated how important the external is. It's like there's a teaching where a question is, what are the bases for realization of stream entry, first level of awakening, which is really accessible to everybody, and the Buddha, Sariputta, points to four things, and one is. Two are external, two are internal. Sort of an equal weight on the external conditions, drawing close to good people, hearing the true teachings, and then internal of wise reflection, wise attention, and then practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, really keeping the internal, direction. So the internal and external need to be supported by each other. Kathy.
So, thank you for your teaching. What I heard is the word just happiness and what sort of leads to happiness. And one of the things that I heard earlier practicing sila leads to the bliss of the blameless life. Mm-hmm. And that's the conditions for happiness, the conditions for samadhi. And then I'm hearing this word boon, which isn't exactly translatable into English. And yet I know that feeling, and just being here today. Like brings, I just feel so much happiness being here with the Sangha, the community, and in the ways that I can support the Dhamma and the Sangha, I know of no greater happiness. I want to sort of say, when I'm with my granddaughter, there's something similar that there's. There's the highest happiness, but this is there's no greater happiness. So I'm thinking of sila, and how when I first came into practice, I was really, you know, I use this word painstaking, but I mean it in a really wholesome way. You know, I practiced, I was painstaking about practicing and studying Sila. And so I really resonated with that, the bliss of the blameless life. And so out of that is a question, is that something in the sutta, is that that's been translated into that the bliss of the blameless life?
Yeah. Anawaja Sukha. That's it's yeah the happiness of blamelessness. That's a there's various elements of blamelessness that the Buddha points to, and part of it is through say like experiencing the fruits of one's livelihood or having perform general or shared, all of those are bases of happiness. But another element is that happiness of blamelessness, and it's directly related to sila, and then sila, it's helpful to reflect on the kind of nuances of sila, because often, especially from a, say, a Judeo-Christian background, we think of sila as morality, and kind of, you know, having rules and being sometimes even being kind of tight about them or feeling restricted by them, but sila is this opportunity to rise up to a life of integrity. And that's a different quality. So, of course, there are certain kind of rules or moral precepts that the Buddha gives, but they're not... They're given in a way that, yeah, again, we have to engage in them, and then by having an integrity of action with intentions of non-harming and not taking advantage of anybody, there's this sense of well-being and happiness. So that sila becomes it's just such a strong base not just living a meditative life, but living a human life, and enjoying it, because having an opportunity to not have harmed or taken advantage of anybody, lived a life of integrity, then there's just incredible well-being. Yeah, there's happiness of blamelessness. It's a so sila is a it's and also sort of looking at it as what how the Buddha presented sila is also as a training. It's a part of a training, so that we're using it not as a kind of a club to either beat ourselves up with because we don't live up to certain standards, or that we use it as a club for criticism of others. It's just, no, this is an opportunity to train ourselves to live in a way that's just really skillful for our benefit and the benefit of others. And yeah, there's a happiness that comes from that.
Thank you, Lampal. And it's also, I think it's like a, I mean, it's almost like it's a compass, like, you know, to be, you know, sort of consistently or just, you know, to re-examine, like you know if you're off, if you're off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's painful.
It's not like, oh, I have to, you know, I need to do some more cleaning here, some yeah. more sweeping, or, yeah. you know,
Yeah, that's what Ajahn Chah always said. Like you know, say the language of Dhamma is the language of feeling. You feel it, you experience it. It's not just an idea that you're trying to live by.
One more.
Thank you for that reflection. Beautiful. I feel like sometimes I have to keep getting a new compass.
Yeah.
Nice cracking. It's like I've appreciated of Zoom, and it's been very helpful on so many levels. But the other thing that I'm going to, and I'm reflecting back to Ajahn Yanako's reading of the Katina, that it's the actual physical presence
mm-hmm.
that also I find I've been missing.
Yeah, we're human beings, and we're actually hardwired to kind of like each other even or appreciate each other's presence.
Yeah, so it's like thinking coming up to the monastery, it's like missing. You know, it's like I appreciated the retreat last year. We did it online, you know, and there'll be another one. And yet, at the same time, there's something when we're all together practicing in the room.
Yeah.
We go out, you know, we sit, then we go walk, we sit, we go walk. We hear these different reflections. But it's like together, you know, in person. And I find I'm missing that. And something in the Katina cloth, it's like when I drive up here, I'm not around the corner. You know, it's a couple hours for me to get here. And I realized when Ajahn Yanako was talking about how the monks had to travel through the rains, to, you know, and their wet robes after this, you know, after the Vasa, just be with the Buddha. And I'm like thinking, oh, that's what I'm having to put that energy to get up here. So where at home, I can just turn on the computer screen, sit in the chair, you know, I was just running around. But here, I actually have to stop. I have to plan my morning to get up here. So the energy actually even starts before I get here to be present with the Dhamma and recognizing it's before I'm even here.
Yeah, and that is one of the great benefits of gathering together, and there are some limitations of Zoom. I said there's great benefits because there are, but then there's also there's limitations, and Ajahn Yanako is because he's been moderating different things and so that's being able to turn off different cameras of different people who plug into the Zoom meeting, but they're sitting there eating, or they're
or they've got the phone in their pocket, cloth.
So not actually, you know, it's not making the effort to sort of, I mean, that's when you're here, you tend to be on your best behavior. Sometimes the people in the front of their own cameras in their homes are a bit casual.